Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here and give this talk, and thank you for the organizer for, you know, putting this interesting meeting together, and, you know, having this whole program here in Santa Barbara, where I will be actually, and later this year I might be here actually for 2 months, so this is to get my feedback. So I'm going to talk about Lagrangian measurements in intense turbulence. So I put in the word intense because yesterday we talked about turbulence, and I want to make sure it's intense and or fully developed, if you want. You could also give it a subtitle, which says how detectors from electron-positron colliders have opened a new window into turbulent mixing, which is like the little subtitle, because you will see that. The experiments are done in my group by NSF funding, together with Alice Crawford, a graduate student who just joined the group in the summer, Otto Laporta, who's a postdoc working on the project now for 2 years, and Greg Voss, who has been with me, I don't know, 4 years now, and he's about to graduate, and actually he's looking for a postdoc, so if you have a position, he's a very bright fellow. I'm also collaborating, you know, why would I have this in here if I wouldn't collaborate with a high-energy physicist from the Laboratory of Nuclear Studies, and it actually turns out that this collaboration made the whole experiment possible, otherwise we wouldn't be where we are now. Well, what's the motivation for the experiment? Well, you would like to look at the time properties of a turbulent flow. I mean, you all know that that we look in the Eulerian frame, we look at the spatial structure of turbulence, and we know that we have some structure function scaling, which goes like epsilon r to some exponent. And what it means is we measure at one point in the flow, and in principle we measure at another point in the flow. What most experiments really do is they use Taylor's frozen flow hypothesis and just sit at one point and measure the time evolution, and then you say, well, this is equivalent to measuring in space. Well, that immediately makes clear to you that if you want to measure the time evolution in the flow, the fluctuation in time evolution, well, you cannot just measure at one point and decide everything that flows by is your signature. You actually have to follow a particle, because otherwise, you know, Taylor's frozen hypothesis wouldn't even work. So the sweeping in the flow will not allow you just to measure at one point. So you actually have to follow the particle while it's traversing through the fluid. So let's say you take a snowflake and a snowstorm, and one you color red, and you just follow the snowflake and the snowstorm. So this is Lagrangian particle tracking, and there's a whole range of the same predictions, you know, Kolmogorov 41, and then the refinements, you can also make for the Lagrangian frame. So you have the Eulerian picture on one side, but there's the Lagrangian picture on the other side, and there are predictions for the scaling of these properties, like for example here the Lagrangian structure function should scale like epsilon tau instead of epsilon r, where tau is the delay times some exponent. In addition, there's a prediction at the small scales. There's a prediction on the acceleration or higher moments of the acceleration, which basically says there's also clear scaling with epsilon to the 3/4. So if the acceleration variance, this would be squared, so we get epsilon to the 3/2 scaling. And it has been shown recently that there's a clear relationship between acceleration and pressure gradients. So if I can measure acceleration quite well, actually I can also make conclusions about the pressure gradients in the flow. Lagrangian measurements are difficult, very difficult. And here's a little history. So typically experiments are limited to microscale Reynolds numbers from 70 to, I guess, 250. They claim 250. I think it's actually, when you look at the flow, it's probably much less. But they're all limited to small Reynolds numbers. And so the difficulty is that you have a particle, and the particle is going through your flow, and you have to follow it. Well, if you do this in a water tunnel, or pretty much you'd have to put particles in, so a water tunnel would be ideal, what you get is you also have a large-scale flow. So if you want to follow a particle in the flow, you also have to move your observation system with the flow, because otherwise your particle will just go through with the mean velocity. So one method is not to have a flow with a mean velocity or very small mean velocity, like a vibrating grid, or you actually put it on a track and a racetrack and just run the cameras that they were used with the mean flow through the experiment. And this was done here. This is a wonderful experiment. I mean, I was extremely impressed by this experiment. What they had done is, first of all, they put the whole experiment on kind of a sled that was moving with the experiment. I think it was, yeah, what was it? It was, let me see. Was wind tunnel, which one was it? Yamamoto, Sato Yamamoto. Was wind tunnel grid turbulence, right. So they were actually moving this on the sled and were moving with the experiment.
The problem with your microphone and the badge, I believe, is generating a rumble there.
Let's just remove the badge.
Yeah, removing the badge. Probably.
You know me now. So, is it better now? Now it's better, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what you had is what they did is basically they put this on the sled and they were moving it with it, and then once they had a particle in focus, they were actually following it with a feedback loop with a zoom camera. So this particle was moving through the flow and they had the zoom camera which was moving in X and Y and at the same time in Z. So this is an amazing experiment. I mean, this is just most amazing. But it shows you how difficult it is to follow particles in a flow. It's just, well, you have experienced that yourself. You know, if you looked at a snowflake and tried to follow it, whereas in a sandstorm out here in California, it's difficult. So this led the theorists to some predictions, or actually it's more a statement of the time. And for example, Steve Pope and T.K. Ewing, they said, you know, Lagrangian statistics is extremely difficult to obtain experimentally because it requires following a fluid particle. And Mark, at the time, I guess he didn't make a prediction for the future. It was actually a statement of the time. You know, he didn't say will not, he said cannot. Okay, so he said this cannot be measured in the laboratory, and it's a study of direct numerical simulations. Well, a few years later, we started to do particle tracking, and we ran exactly in the same problem. It just was not possible to do. And so what my rest of the talk is about, well, we have actually finally figured out how to do it, and we have good, some very nice results, I think. And before I do that, let me just introduce the flow. The flow we are studying is the French washing machine. It's the counter-rotating disc. So here you have two discs where the engineers, these are basically two centrifugal pumps with vanes in them, and they have a wall on the side and a lid on the top. So what happens is, it's just like you would build a primitive centrifugal pump, the fluid is being sucked in here and blown out here. So what that leads to is that you get a flow like this because you have two of these counter-rotating, so one goes this way and the other one the other way, so you get a counter-rotating flow, and so we call this the pumping mode, because there's actually a large-scale flow with like meter per second velocities larger. And then you also have a shearing flow, and in shearing flow, you just get enormous amount of shear introduced in the fluid because you have these two plates moving against each other. The turbulence parameters, you might, nowadays, this is a slide from about a few weeks ago, we now think that this Reynolds number is probably only half of what it is here. It's probably more like 1,000 instead of 2,000, but it's still large. The microscale is the typically velocity fluctuations are half a meter per second up to a meter per second. The length scale might only be 10 centimeters instead of 20. And the problem is once you go to these very high Reynolds numbers, the Kolmogorov scale is actually quite tiny. It's down in the 50 micron, 20 micron range. And so if you do acceleration measurements, you know, you want to look at the small scales, and you also want to look at particles which are roughly of the size of the Kolmogorov length scale, because otherwise you might run into problems. The Kolmogorov time is 0.5 milliseconds, which also shows you when you look at the small scales, you want to get right time resolution down to the 0.5 millisecond range. Let me show you a picture of the experiment. So here it is. It's always, we had a poster at the ATS meeting, and that's why I have all these pretty pictures. So here we have the apparatus, this is an inch, from spot to spot is an inch, so this is about 60 centimeters across, a meter high. It's a very nice confined experiment. It's actually something you could in principle carry out of your lab if you have to. We put a kilowatt of power into it here and here. There's quite a bit of loss in the bearings and so on, so we think that roughly a kilowatt gets dissipated in the flow. We can regulate the temperature, and so we have a 6-watt argon laser, we shine light through, we have little particles in the flow. These particles, you know, refract light, and we pick up the light with two detectors, and I will talk about how we do that. Before I go into this, let me just say that this flow, of course, got famous initially for looking at coherent structures in the flow, and so what we did is we did measurements where we looked at real-world cavitation. So instead of putting bubbles in and just track the flow, we did actually cavitation measurements. And this would be one of these. You look in the middle of the system and you see one of these cavitation events, where I should say that these are actually light flashes, which just have been integrated by the camera. So you see cavitation, and we use that to get a handle or get some idea about the pressure fluctuations in the flow. And so this is a paper that's hopefully coming, being soon to be accepted in physics of fluids. And what we have measured is basically if this is the pressure distribution of the flow, so you go down the very small, possibly negative pressures, there's prediction that there should be an exponential decay, and our measurements pretty much point, I mean, everything we can dream up from these measurements point in the direction that everything is exponential, and that we have a pressure constant, we have this decay constant alpha, which is a function of R lambda. What we were measuring is we were having bubbles of about 100 micron in the flow. Well, they're unavoidable, it turns out. We couldn't get rid of the bubbles. No, they are generated at the props. Then there's no cavitation behind the propellers, and then in the bulk there's a bulk cavitation, which is, seems to be independent of, you're very far away from the propellers. It's actually quite nice. It's wonderful to watch. Okay, so as I said, the particle tracking system looks like this. We have the 6 watt argon laser beam. You observe it 45 degrees. It turns out that this way you get the most intensity out of your particles. And then we have to read out the data and just run it through a computer and analyze it. Well, now how do we do the measurements? How do you do Lagrangian tracking? Well, one idea would be, like all the other experiments have done, well, you put in tracer particles in your turbulent flow. You try to make them passive, which means you make them tiny and hopefully density measure them to the fluid. And then you just take a video camera. And then when you put the numbers in and you realize the flow we have, you realize you want a camera that does about 100 kilohertz frame rate. And you realize that something like this doesn't exist. And even if it exists, if you don't have direct processing, on-chip processing, the data will be so enormous it would break any computer. Because if you have to store every pixel of your, let's say, 512 by 512 image, you would just not have enough data. So, you know, modern CCD technology where you actually put processing on the chip might actually solve that, but that's not available yet. I mean, it's being developed. So what we did is we found out that they have a detector over in Clio 3 and the electron-positron collider. They use silicon strip detectors to look for charged particles. And it turns out that they have the characteristic of the false readout rates that we need. And in addition, what they're just a thin silicon strip, 300 microns thick, with P and N strips on each side, so they're little, basically, wires. So it's like if you think about it, it's like a one-dimensional photodiode array, but long, on each side. And so this way we have reduced the data from 512 times 512 to 512 plus 512, which is much, much smaller. And, of course, it has a disadvantage, because if you want to look at multiple particles, this picture here, actually, you wouldn't know. You know, whether this part and this part, this line belongs to here, but this line belongs to here because the colors are misleading. You know, when we measure it, we wouldn't have the colors, right? They're not green electrons, blue electrons coming out and red electrons. They're just charges. So what we do is by doing time correlation techniques, because we get many images, we can actually get up to, let's say we can up to follow about 5 to 6 to 10 particles at a time. Okay, let me do that again. So you have the moving particles like this, and you want to image them out on a detector, right? So what you have is you have an optics and you image out the volume out of the flow onto your 2D detector, right? Which is this thing here. And so what that means is when you have a particle in view, the particle will refract light, will just start to glow, and you image this on the detector, and then on the detector you get a streak of light, which is like, you know, just a streak of light, and you want to read out this streak of light. In the high-energy experiment, that's different, because in the high-energy experiment, there's a particle coming through, and that's it. So their electronics, we had to modify the electronics to get the high readout rates, because they would never read out continuously. We read it out continuously. But it kind of was there, you know, was very close. Yes? Oh, the three-dimension actually turns out to be quite difficult to do. Right now, we're doing 2D. Mostly, all the measurements that I show 2D, there will be one measurement where I do 3D with two detectors. To really do thorough measurements to reduce the error in 3D, to get your error bars down, you have to use four detectors. It turns out that the ideal situation is 4 detectors. And that was shown by Dracos and Variant in Switzerland. And Mann has done that from... Right, and that's why you need 3 detectors, not good enough, you need 4. And so it will be quite an investment. Since we built these detectors ourselves, you know, we just have to build enough detectors to get the experiment going. So here's a picture of the detector. So this was clear, Itamar? Yeah. So this is the detector. So what we have is we have here the silicon strip, which is about 5 centimeters by 2.5 centimeters. This dimension is given from the high-energy physics experiment. We take this from the high-energy physicists. Then we have a hybrid board, which we modify to our requirements together with the high-energy physicists. Then there's an RC chip, actually for the experimentalists, if they want to see. They can just find their way alone on this slide. I won't explain it. And then you have an RC chip, and then you read this out, and there are multiplexer chips right here. So we get 128. The signals are multiplexed. 128 of them are multiplexed out of this coming out multiplex, and we read out at about 10 megahertz, the data. And then we read it into the computer, into a fast scope card, then we go through the data and throw out all the data that we sparsify the data, and then we store it away. And so with this method, we can measure, we can acquire about 9 gigabytes of data, which corresponds to about 3 million events in about 4 days. That's the data rate that we get. So here's a picture of the of some position measurements. So here's the position measurement versus time step. What this experiment is, we look at a small volume of about half a centimeter across, and we just track particles. These different colors are for different particles that the program identified as being different particles. This is, of course, just a one-dimensional measurement here. And what you see is one thing we have to fight with is that some of these lines are bad, so we actually have little chunks in the data, and we take great care in figuring out what systematic errors that might incorporate in our data analysis. So this is one of the, so you have dead pixels, you have dead lines on your detector. Down here, just to show you that we have enough time resolution, I should mention, we take, the data is taken at up to 70 kilohertz. This detector allows us to take data up to 70 kilohertz, and we have 512 strips, and we have sub-pixel resolution. If you look at a millimeter squared area, we have a resolution down to about 0.1 microns. And that's true because we illuminate more than one. The light spot that comes back illuminates more than one strip, and we can do averaging and get out a better resolution.
So that's the velocity component for that.
That's the velocity. This is just these curves differentiated. Yes. And you see, I mean, the data is very smooth. I mean, this is done without smoothing. This is not fitting. This is just... So the data is very, very smooth, and it works quite well. Well, then you ask, what does the flow look like? Does the flow have some surprises? I mean, one measurement we have done is we have measured the fluctuating velocity as a function of disk rotation frequency. And what we find is that, depending on what component we measure, we see that the velocity scales linear and the disk rotation frequency, which is what you would expect if there are no surprises in the flow. It's just a pump, right? Okay, so we think there are no significant changes in the large-scale flow. Please watch that at this time the measurements were only going down to 2 hertz, and now we have actually measurements down to 0.1 hertz, but I don't have the data yet. I have only the data on the acceleration. So now let me come to the acceleration measurements. And so there's this Kolmogorov prediction that, let me show you that prediction, if I can find it. So... I mean, there's this prediction that the acceleration variance should scale like epsilon to the 3/2. And this is what I'm after now. Okay, this is what I want to measure. So I will measure the acceleration statistics. I will measure the acceleration PDFs. I will measure the acceleration variance as a function of Reynolds number. And since we have, as I will explain later, it's difficult for us to measure the Reynolds number, but we know what the velocity is, the fluctuating velocity is, and under the assumption that we have a constant length scale in the flow. The large scale length scale is the same. What we can do is we can plot the acceleration variance versus u to the 9/2, and if we agree with Kolmogorov, it should be a straight line. But before, of course, you have to take the data. And so let me go back. So one of the challenges of particle tracking for anybody that does this is that if you take, for example, a data like this, where you have the position in pixels versus the time in frames, what you want to know is the acceleration. And we do this by fitting a parabolic function, so second-order polynomial, to the data. And what is, of course, clear is that if you fit to short distances, you just fit to the noise. I mean, that's it, right? You get enormous acceleration because it's just what your noise does. If you're too conservative, well, you just smooth out the whole data and you don't get garbage again. And since you want to be precise and get really down to like 5%, 10% errors, you have to be a little, you know, you have to think about a lot about your data analysis. And so what we do is we plot the acceleration variance as a function of fit interval, which is given here in tau eta. This data is taken for about a 1.5 by 1.5 millimeter by 1.5 millimeter volume. So the particle is moving through this volume, and we're measuring at this small scale the acceleration. You know, this is one of these tracks through this volume. And this is tau eta, and just remember what the tau eta was, what was it, about a kilohertz. So a millisecond. So, you know, this is basically tracking over, like, typically a millisecond. And then what you get here is, what we do is we look at this data, and what you see is that where it's too short, the acceleration is much too large. Where you're smoothing out, the acceleration goes small. So what we do is we fit a straight line to this region of the plot and extrapolate to zero fit interval. And that gives us the experimental, quote-unquote, experimental value of the acceleration. That's the best we can do. We have also developed, working with a high-energy physicist, is quite amazing. They tell you, well, we do this all the time. We simulate our data. They actually simulate the whole process from data taking. They make artificial data. They run it through your whole process, and at the end something comes out, and then they go back and say, was it the same thing that I put in? And so we have started doing this. We have a program written that simulates the whole process of data taking, takes our analysis. They have to generate artificial data, which is actually very challenging. And then I'm still working on getting some theoretically DNS data to feed into my program. But what you do is you basically take the data, you run it through this Monte Carlo simulator, and at the end you see, does that what you put in actually come out at the end, just to make sure that you simulate. And then you also learn about systematic errors. You know where are your errors, and you can identify them. So we've also done that, which is not clear from this slide. So let me just show you a acceleration distribution function. So the probability versus the acceleration scaled by its variance. And the one thing that peaks in your eye is, well, there are tails. I mean, there are tails, long tails. And they go out. The amazing thing is, this is an R lambda of about 760. These are 3 million samples. And you go out all the way out to about 30 sigma with this data. So you get rare events. You know, this is 10 to the minus 6, which is not very large. But you have very, very long tails in this distribution. And the flatness is quite enormous. Now, you could ask the question, do we have enough data to even think about higher order, your second order moments, which would be the acceleration variance, and higher order moments? So the easiest way to find this out for us is just to plot out what we would integrate over. So this is just a squared times p of a, and you see, well, this is wonderfully converged, right? We are well out to zero at 20. So if you look at this data, definitely the acceleration variance measurements they work, as far as we are concerned. If you go to the fourth moment, then, well, it doesn't look quite as good, right? And we haven't done it, because it looks like we have not converged yet with this. And one problem is not so much that it is coming from, there's a possible reason is that we have systematic errors in the data because of these jumps, because there are these empty spots in the data. Well, I didn't calculate it, but we skipped it, yeah. No, but I would suspect it's actually converged. It should definitely, we should see it. We can do it. Well, it looks like it does, right? I mean, when you look at this, you see that it actually comes down, right? I mean, to me it does. I would say some people, it's probably some data that we see. If you make the plots like this, you would find that they don't even look as good as this one. Do they look much better? Much better. Well, I've not. And it depends on the systematic errors, but you know the other detectors are so refined that you don't run against these problems. Okay. Well, now you have the question is, you know, you would ask, of course, you immediately would come to me and say, well, you know, is this real? You know, is that real or is this just something that I made up? You know, is this a measurement error? Because, you know, by making chumps in your data, you can make all kinds of wonderful accelerations. And so we went in and actually did a 3D particle tracking with two detectors, which is kind of tricky.
Is that unit reproducible in 2D?
Yeah.
So it's due to the right?
Looks like it. Well, Well, this one is now overlaid data for different Reynolds numbers gained by the variance. So you can pick up each individual one. So that's why I said, you know, is it, this is probably more trustworthy than the other. Well, it looks skewed, but, you know, I don't know. Pardon me? I just have to calculate it. I give you the answer tomorrow, okay? Don't worry. You're in a workshop. So this is the same plot, you know, done for different Reynolds numbers and where we just have collapsed, you know, where we collapsed the data. And what you see is that for the small Reynolds numbers, this thing starts to bend over earlier, and the higher the Reynolds numbers, the further you go down on this plot. Yes? Right. Well, from the simulation by Hills and Sorensen and other people, they've pretty much shown that, Mark might be able to help me with this, but I think they've pretty much shown that the viscous parts are very, very small, tiny. Was it Ewing? It's a few percent or a few percent of the other effect. Was it Ewing?
Yeah, Ewing and Goto are here.
Ewing and Goto, right? Goto is here, right? He can. No. I don't, I mean, according to the simulation, it's not. I mean, it's like a percent effect.
Let me ask what may be a related question. Why do you have broader tails than
you mean, why does it go wider? Why does it sort of flatten out here? Why does it go this way?
Why is low Reynolds number turbulence more?
You want to show this? That may be related to what you said. From the paper of Hume and Vidula.
Oh, here it is. I have it. Fantastic, yeah. So now let's see which one was what. I have to remember. This one and this one, right? This one, right? Oh, this one.
This one.
Right.
This is the ratio of the.
Oh, it could be very important, the tails. Ah, now I get it. So what Mark says is that Urey's point is that in the tails, the viscous term can be very important, which I could actually believe. Yes, right. So well, let me show you. Let me just go on because I'm still not done. So what we have done is we have done 3D particle tracking just to show you how wild these events are. So this is a real particle track. This is a particle track at a Reynolds number of about 760. And we have, here's the time resolution, so this is half a tau eta, so we have taken the, so this is a little warning to the people that do simulations. We are looking at this data at a resolution of 8 frames on half a tau eta. So this is how the quality of our measurement is. And this is the trajectory of a particle going through 3-dimensional space. This is 70 eta. And what you find is that there are regions in the flow where the acceleration goes very, very, very high. It's mostly because the particle we think is trapped in a vortex. The particle is moving around in the vortex, and the numbers look outrageous if you think about it. I mean, it's actually, if you think about it, they're not. But they are 16,000 meters per second squared. Now, these are tiny objects, and they go around on tiny circuits, and so you realize it's not that outrageous. The number doesn't actually make sense. So we actually have very, very precise, so this detector gives us enormous resolution on the data. I mean, it's just got wonderful resolution. I should also mention that there's much less known about Lagrangian statistics of a turbulent flow, theoretically, that much less has been done than on the Eulerian frame. So let me just come to the punchline. So, well, if you plot the acceleration variance versus the velocity in meters per second, the same way I had it defined before, what we find is a U to the 9/2 law very well down, even for the small acceleration, for the small Reynolds numbers, it's still pretty good. But it doesn't, you know, it obviously deviates. And of course, plotting the data like this is something that Eric showed me right away. He said, well, don't plot the data like this. Plot it as a deviation from the power law so you can see what's going on. And so here's the truth. So what you have here, so this is the U to the 9/2 law. And then the data starts to come over at smaller velocities. It definitely turns over. Okay? Now you could ask, can we compare with numerical DNS simulations? What? Well, this is only a velocity on it. I come to this. So you would ask, well, can we compare with the simulations? Well, it's intrinsically hard to measure. It's very difficult to measure dissipation in this flow because you have no mean velocity. So all the methods on hot wire, hot probe measurements, you cannot do. So what we try to do right now is to measure spatial velocity gradients by measuring two particles at a time. And we're getting there. We're getting close, but it's more difficult. And so in the meantime, what we have done is, in the olden days, what we did is we just looked at the acceleration correlation function, looked at how it decayed, and compared that to DNS and kind of pulled out of that a tau eta, a Kolmogorov time. And from there, we kind of related to the Reynolds number. That's the best we could do. And at the same time, we looked at the DNS data and kind of made sure that we are consistent. It looks like we are sitting on the data. So this should be, this plot should be taken with question mark, okay? Because both this scale and that scale, which is this is the constant of the power law, this is the or lambda, both of these scale together. Both of them scale in different ways. So nevertheless, this is our best comparison right now, kind of a working slide. So this is the theoretical simulations I'm told by Godot that you can now go up to an R lambda of like 400 almost, and you too, right? Roughly up there. So there should be soon a point up here, I hope. But nevertheless, I mean, you see that we see this turnover, and there seems to be Kolmogorov scaling. I should warn that because of this, because we don't know what the Reynolds number really is, this A0 could be anything from 2 or 2.5, from 2 all the way up to perhaps 4, 5, perhaps even 8, but we just don't know. We think it's smaller, it's probably between 2 and 4, but we really don't know. Yes? Yes, right. Thank you. Right. Well, we suspect that it does. We have no proof of it. We have to measure this velocity relations, perhaps, and other things. Especially somebody suggested to go off-center. We should go off-center and do measurements off-center to see how the isotropy gets lost. You know, we should just go in the region where we have some mean velocity and just see, you know, how we are doing. So what you see there is a, you know, what you see here as a deviation could well be that this is our flow. That just looks now like the propellers here, you have to imagine, these propellers rotate by 0.2 hertz or something. I mean, they go like, we can stand there and see them rotate. I mean, there's nothing going on. We have beaten the problem of particles. If your particles are on a density match, you lose them. And so how we fight that is once in a while, we speed up the apparatus, then wait. The particles get resuspended, then we wait long enough for everything to calm down, and then we start to measure again. So, you know, every half hour the apparatus goes haywire, and then it comes down. So let me just show you the last two slides that I have. One question is that people had was, are there size effects, particle size effects? Can we say something about this? And so we have done experiments with different particles and different density ratios, and by putting salt into the water. And basically the result is the following. So this is, let's look at this first. So we have here 50 micron particles and 460 micron particles. Our paper that was published in Physics of Fluids, we used 460 micron particles, so large particles, with an old detector that was much harder to use, much larger signal to noise, lower signal to noise. And so what you see immediately is that there's a big difference between here and here. So obviously the larger particles actually average out some information of the flow. The other interesting thing is if you go to the large particles, you just change the density of quite a range, you see a very little effect. The other interesting feature is that if you scale everything by the variance, well, then you wouldn't even know that there were particles of different size and different density in your flow. There might be a slight deviation back here, and you might have to go down to 10 to the minus 6 to really see, you know, differences. But at this range, you don't see much of an effect. There's a little effect in the tails, but it's not that pronounced. Now you can put this on some plots. So here, for example, is the relative change of the acceleration as a function of particle diameter, and you see it changes almost by a factor of 2. And then up here, this straight line is just the guide to the eye. It's probably not justified. It probably turns over here. So you see that for small particles of the size of the Kolmogorov size, which is about 50 microns, we have no problems. We resolve the flow. While for particles that are larger, we definitely underestimate accelerations quite a bit. It's an interesting problem by itself. As far as I know, there's no theory on prediction of what particles would do, what the influence of particle sizes on the acceleration measurement. the variance versus sparse density is very weak. You know, it goes from 0.35 to 0.25. So we think that's a small contribution. And let me just put up the slide, the conclusion slide. So we have precise Lagrangian acceleration measurements. We do these experiments with this newly designed strip detector, which without the help from the high-energy physicists and even their equipment, we do all the wire bonding. We, you know, like on the chip, we use these little aluminum wires and weld them across. Without their equipment, it would be just totally impossible. We hope that in the next generation, we will have this detector with the company, and the company can actually produce one for us and for everybody else in the community. So very high data rates, relatively high resolution. The acceleration distribution is highly intermittent. The acceleration variance obviously scales. I mean, we're pretty sure now that it follows Kolmogorov scaling, which is perhaps not too surprising. The acceleration is strongly dependent on particle size, weakly dependent on density. And then we have these very large rare events where we have these very strong vortical structures which seem to be out in the tails of the distribution. We are working on actually quantifying that and see how, what's the percentage of these in the flow and how many do we have. It's a very difficult experiment because you don't know how to, what you call a strong vortical structure, what a weak one, and you don't know which ones you catch with the particle and which ones you don't. So this one is kind of a big question mark. It could be related to the worms that were seen in Tobeling's experiment, but we don't know that for sure. Well, thank you very much. Yes, yes.
But as far as worms as an interpretation, you take a two-dimensional...
I can explain to you. Let me answer the first question.
Right.
Go on.
That's not really a question. My real question is, a worm, a two-dimensional vortex, it's a steady-state object. It has no acceleration. You put a particle, it will just go around. Having worms as the explanation doesn't seem right to me. I mean, we see the worms in the turbulence, but I'm not saying... That doesn't seem to be what it would be. Now, there's a paper by Soraya's group in Australia which looked at acceleration from the DNS from a different point of view, and I think tried to look at the structure.
I don't know that paper, so...
I'll see if I can remember what the right
okay. Well, the acceleration, if you sit down, actually, just think about it a little longer, you will realize it's not unreasonable. The velocity fluctuations are about a meter per second.
Okay.
And then you put in the distances and you realize it makes sense. Because it runs around a tiny circuit, right? A few Kolmogorov length.
Yeah, right. You have to find the eta p over L on your first conservative. Can you help measure that?
Oh, let me... You mean this one, right? It's a different slide, but it's the same thing. You mean this one? Can we measure T0? Oh, you mean just the higher powers? Can we measure the higher powers? Well, we think we can. You know, once we have figured out what the systematic error is, this was only running for 3 days, right? For this plot, and we already went down to 10-6. So we should get enough convergence at least on the next one. You know, perhaps whether we can go up much higher remains to be seen. The one thing we're going to be working on, I mean, so far we have only worked on the dissipation scale, right? But the next thing, of course, is to look at the inertia scale, you know, at the velocities and two particle correlations, dispersion, which we should all be able to do.
One last question.
Just a quick comment. One, I think the colleague John Mullen would be shocked to know that there's no work on the relation between size and acceleration.
Well, he has done some, yes. No, I know. No, we have been looking at that literature. Well, we've looked at this data. I've talked to him. So. I mean, he's my colleague, right? So. Well, you know, he's in the right next door, right? So.
That's why I'm surprised what you said. The second thing is, what you call Kolmogorov scaling, I think in fact was first proposed by Korsen. It's in Kolmogorov variables, but I think Korsen was the first
Oh, to apply the Lagrangian, that could be, yeah, we just, yeah.
Go ahead, you have a question.
The U, the T at one point, but we can't do that, right? We cannot. We would have to put a hot wire probe or something in there too. Well, we have no large scale flow, so since we are following particles, right? How would you measure that? Yeah, but how would you measure that in a flow that? Yeah, but the other systems, you see, the other systems all require a lot. We're measuring it. See, this flow is very inhomogeneous and anisotropic. I mean, it's a flow that's not perfect by no means. And we're measuring right in the middle where there's no mean velocity. So we don't really know. We don't have that number. I mean, it would be nice to have another probe. Perhaps if you would have a laser Doppler, you know, if you would have a false laser Doppler velocimetry system or something, you might pull that data out. I don't know whether they would be fast enough to do it. They should.
Okay.
They should be. Right,
we better go on.
We could.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
How do you measure for us?